This afternoon, now let's talk a bit about coming to a perspective of pastoral care. And any approach to caring for the dying has to deal with the teaching of the two things of death. And by the two things of death, I'm talking the two concerns that seem to become the areas of pain and areas of problematic for the dying person. Assuming that this morning we worked out all the problems of denial and society and all, and we've got the person trying to deal with it. What is he dealing with? And the first thing of death is the threat of death itself. It's meaningful. The threat of death, colon, is meaningful. Now, in psychoanalytic terms, this becomes a problem Saint Sigmund talks about in his 40th. And he talks about the unconscious being unable to comprehend its own annihilation as it thinks. That is, it's psychologically, unconscious, I can't conceive of the point in which I, as a psyche, I as a self, will cease to exist. Tillich, I think, puts it a little more clearly for us when he talks about the existential anxiety of non-being. It is a human being, we seem to be the only creatures who can transcend ourselves for any time, and this life, and know that not only are we sitting here in St. Louis at this point, but that we can look back to the time when we were born, and we can look forward to the anticipated time when we die. And when we die is a fact that we will cease to be non-being. I'm not saying that existential anxiety of non-being is just that, but I think in terms of what we're talking about today, it's a point to this. So if somehow, whatever you want to do to help the dying person, I don't think the same is true. You're going to have to help them come to grips with the problem of death and its meaning. Now, this becomes dominant theme for some persons, while the second theme of death becomes a more dominant theme for others, and that is, this is one that I give credit to Joseph for opinion. I used to be on our faculty until he died last year. We used to call the theme of death as a separation from our fellow men. That one of the pains of death is the realization that when we die, we are separated from all that we have ever known, we have loved, we have hidden in every social aspect of our life. Friends, family, work, play, all that we've known in this existence is being taken away from us. Now, attached to the perspective of things, we must be concerned with both of these to see if we effectively and responsibly minister to the dying person. I think sometimes we have emphasized just the grief process, the territory of grief. And we help them work through giving up their family, we help them work through the stages of the drama to where they are able to get up there. But we have not helped them with the problem of the meaning of it. We have failed to guide them along the pathways of the valley that lead them to be able to feel its appropriateness at both levels. Now, we talked some about preparing people. You talked about how your family, your father, has prepared you and your childhood in talking about death. But it seems to me if we follow the theme of death imagery for a moment, we might talk about building up a ministry. Some of us can build up an immunity to a thing, so that it's not quite as toxic. Others of us can be hyper-allergic to the toxic quality of a thing. And a venom can be, well, we know, for example, a wasp sting. For some people, the venom can be fatal. While others, it just creates a wealth. But the pain is usually there for most of us. So, to be aware of how these two things affecting a particular parishioner requires some type of pastoral assessment, some ability to assess where this person is and what he's struggling with. And I call these the human vital signs. You know, the physician's immediate concern when he calls his face on the floor of the hospital is he has a vital sign first, and they're tied as regularly as faith of Christ. That verse is called Sympathy of Suffering. Well, I see, and maybe a little problem in sight, but I see that there's some human Bible times that we need to focus on if we're going to be sensitive to what this person's struggling with and how the two things of death are suffering. The first Bible sign is our sensitivity to the focus of concern of the person. The person's focus of concern. Acknowledging that this dynamically changes, that what is my focus of concern today may not be tomorrow because of what other things happen to me. But what is it that this person is centering his inner energy upon? Is it upon the operation and whether or not it will be turned out to be malignant or whether it will be operable? Is it on my business who's going to succeed me and take over? Is it on the family? How's my wife going to go along? Is it on the finances and the tremendous cost? Is it on will I have a lot of pain? Where is the focus of concern? On the illness, on the prognosis, on something that is affected by the illness in terms of family, business, and so on. The danger is that we all too often think that whatever we would be concerned about in that patient's situation would be what he's concerned about. I know if I were right now filled with cancer, which I may be, but if I were aware of it lying in the bed, I would have concerns about my wife and four kids and mortgage and everything else that's piled on. But that doesn't mean that if I run into a man of my age, or maybe a minister, who's lying in the bed, that that's his focus of concern. Can we acknowledge the difference between identifying with a patient where we assume he feels or he feels? And using our gut feeling to know how we would feel, but then going a step forward and saying, okay, that's how I would feel, now is that the way you feel? And the focus of concern is to know what your focus of concern would be, that's helpful. But to check, is that what this person's concerned about? And to recognize that as long as a person is alive and dynamic, and is involved with life, that this will be changing from moment to moment. You change. Physically have changed, your other concerns. When it becomes sick, or arrested, or obsessive, and this person has ceased to move. For example, one can be caught in the drama of anger and never move beyond it because the focus of concern is stuck on a given concern about anger of God or so on, and they can't work beyond it. Our goal is to use this vital sign of the focus of concern as a way of getting a clue on where this person is and what he's struggling with today when I make my call and start with him and visit with him. The second vital sign we need to be concerned about is our sensitivity to circumstances. Being sensitive to the circumstances of this person. And he's just one of the biggest areas of the profession. We learn certain methods, and that's as far as we go, because unfortunately those methods tend to be in our own field. Especially what we develop their own way, the nurse their own way, the physician his own way, and the minister his own way. Ted Draper, the thousand pastor care, emphasizes the problems of clergy running into a nursing past their diagnosis, a past their affection, taking into account the circumstances. As you know, you're familiar with Ed Draper, a psychoanalyst who's now at the University of Michigan. He went to Garrett and was a Methodist minister prior to going into psychiatry. And he likes to reflect on the difference between his theology and theological training and his medical training. In medical school, 75% of his training is on treatment, on diagnosis. On diagnosis. Only 25% on treatment. And quackery is treating without coming to a conclusion about it, without diagnosing. And he said the physician tries to avoid quackery by learning to make accurate diagnosis, because the treatment for one type of symptomatology may be fatal if you miss it. That is, the medication that's needed for a coronary and the medication needed for an asthmatic attack, even though both may be identical treatments, the necessary treatment for one is fatal for the other. And the physician has to know which it is. He has to make an accurate Then get the statement to see the latest one out of the book on the shelf, if he makes the right diagnosis. But he contrasts that with his training in the seminary, where it was the opposite. 75% was on treatment. The diagnosis is automatic. We assume it all in the seminary. So what we learn to do is how to face it. And we fail to recognize the subtleties of how individuals are seen. And what that means. Well, here, circumstances are one of the most important vital signs in understanding who this person is and the ecology around them in relationships. For example, are we thirsty for the personal and family history and how the earlier chapters in this person's pilgrimage are affecting this present chapter? And here I point very strongly to the importance of recognizing unresolved grief. The person who has failed to work through grief or the loss into the past will have a problem in working through the anticipatory grief of his own death. The same can be said about the family. Unresolved grief around the loss of a marriage and divorce, unresolved grief around the loss of a job and retirement, both retirement and the person wants ready to quit working, unresolved grief in being uprooted from one city and transplanted to another city without taking hold and away from family. These griefs, which produce so much of the physical illness in our hospitals, can also become helpful or destructive in the patient's ability to cope with his own death. Are we sensitive to the variables of age, social role, vocation, and all of those things that make up this particular individual style of life and personality? I think I said before lunch it's easier for some of us to accept the death of an 80-year-old than there's an 8-year-old, but we somehow feel that it's more appropriate. Back last year, a year ago this week, the AOTC had their meeting in Dallas while my father-in-law was critically ill in intensive care in Dallas. So my wife jumped on the plane, and my wife's playing in a bingo. It doesn't cost anything until you get the card there. And she just spent the whole week out at the hospital visiting her father. She did put poetry at 77 years of age and drove up to see us last fall. Believe it or not, the doctor said, any time now, any time. And so my wife came down there. I was at lunch with four or five of the pastoral counselors. One of them said, I thought your wife came with me. I said, yeah, didn't you go and be at lunch with her? And I said, no, she's spending all the time over at the hospital with her father. Oh, she said, she said, well, he's having a few coronary and since he's still in oxygen, the doctor said, could be any time. And then a friend of mine, whom I've known for about 8 years, into this thing, pastor. She said, well, how old is he? I said, well, he's 77. And if you get this father said, oh, well, he's lived in this long life. Now, I had a hunch that if my father-in-law lived to be 177, that my wife is going to be his death. And first. And knowing how stubborn he is, I have a hunch he's going to fight it if he lives to 177. He's always said he wants to live long enough to see my daughter put me through what I put him through. But we do, whether consciously or unconsciously, let circumstances affect us. Age, role, social role. Remember the lady, 37 years old, whose death warrant was written because she was of no social value throughout society, single, no children, black, and poor. Are we aware of how these circumstances are influencing the patient, his family, and us in terms of our attitude? Are we aware of the duration and type of illness, its intensity, and its longevity? Some families have certain kinds of words that are magic in terms of danger. Cancer, in some families, panic people. Leukemia, in some families, are panic. Based upon previous experience, the circumstances. My own case, my closest conversion, which is a very long and fatal illness of the skin, or disease of the skin, which the finally kills, but that's only after everything scales off regularly. Every time you get a patient in the hospital with this, I have all kinds of reactions my father-in-law and my wife and my brother-in-law and sister-in-law as to how they remember. And if anybody in our family were to get that, they would bring up the whole bag again. Families have their own bags of thanksgiving. Are we sensitive to this in terms of knowing how it affects them? Are we sensitive to the family equilibrium? This is where the parish pastor has a particular advantage, it seems to me, over the chaplain. Because he has the opportunity to be aware of how a family maintains its balance, its equilibrium, in a non-crisis situation as well as crisis situation. And how is this illness affecting the equilibrium of the family, their balance? Some equilibriums, you know, are maintained in unhealthy ways. That is, the needs of others are not at the expense of a particular member. That's called scapegoating. A healthy family equilibrium is where the needs of each member of the family are being met adequately in the family unit, the family structure. But you, I'm sure, have seen where a husband or a wife or a particular child is scapegoating, and they become the brunt. And they maintain an equilibrium as long as that guy is the black sheep. What about it when this patient gets sick? What does this do to the equilibrium in the patient's illness? If it's the wife and she has handled all the house and decided the traveling salesman, he may be lost as to how to take the strain for the kids. If it's a husband who was the dominant one who took care of everything all the time, made all the decisions, and the wife may be totally alone and not even know how to pay a bill, and the equilibrium can really be thrown out of place. Are we sensitive not only to how they're reacting now, but how that fits the history of how they reacted, of how they cope with previous crises? A family who has learned as a family to cope with previous crises, maybe a death, maybe some other hardship, well, if they've learned these constructive, creative ways, they'll be more prepared to meet this crisis. The ones who didn't learn how to do it effectively will wind up having more conflict with this one. The patient will be affected by how the family's equilibrium is maintained. And a family's equilibrium may very well be so much in jeopardy, so precarious, at the thought of losing a husband and father, that they may be forced into maintaining denial, long beyond the patient having made for acceptance. This will deny them the opportunity, the privilege, the responsibility of walking through the valley of the shadow of death with that patient, because their equilibrium could not take it, and they're forced to deny it. Third vital sign, are we sensitive to the family's expectations, to the patient's expectations, and to our own expectations, threefold expectations? Are we sensitive to the expectations of patient, family, husband? The type of death and the prognosis of what they think is going to happen. By type of death, I mean many patients will expect it to be long and drawn out, and this will cause them considerably more anger and frustration, or perhaps depression. Others will not be so much concerned about the duration of the illness and how long, but they will be concerned about what to expect ultimately. Let's get this back to the thing of death of its meaning. Are we sensitive to the incongruency that exists between the patient and his family as to expectations? Are we sensitive to expectations and the attitude toward the illness and its result to what they've been told? Patients will tell you things very different from what the doctor will tell you about a patient. Doctors say, I told him it was malignant, the patient will tell you, I have a growth in my eye. And the fungus, as one patient told me, he had an eye removed from a tomb, so they found a fungus in my eye. That's quite clear that his denial is at work. Others will avoid the use of the word malignancy, or if you say malignancy, a family will immediately assume death. So others will, who have had successful experiences with previous malignancies, may have expectations that will look at. And live on a vital life. After all, Uncle George had malignancy 20 years ago, and look at him, he lived until he was 84. And they may expect the patient. But if, on the other hand, malignancy and 3 months later he was dead, they may think this will happen to this person. Now, the expectations regarding you may be involved in these two. for their guilt and for their sins and make them feel guilty. Are their expectations of you as a helper and a friend? Do they expect that when you walk in the room that means they're going to die because nobody sings for the pastor until it's too late? You see how this gets in the way? Are you listening for what they expect? Are their situation and the view? And are you listening for the incongruences so that you can help them? Now here it seems to me is the best opportunity we have of helping symptomize the family and the patient. And I don't know very many people in the hospital professionals who get involved in this, or anybody better equipped for it than you. You know, if you put two gears together, supposedly they're too small. And we know the gears work smoothly. But in the dynamic quality of dying, very often the patient may be at the stage of anger, and the family is at the stage of denial. And when the gears come together, they can't move. The peace has been peace. And the family becomes stuck with the patient. And they may be forced for movement to back off. And the family goes into their valley of the shadow, working through the inner subjective death and physical grief of the lost and loved one. And the patient continues to move over into his valley, and they die separate. He died separate from his family, and they have extra guilt and frustrations as a result. Seems to me that we, as pastors, need to concern ourselves with being sensitive to these expectations and what's going on in such a way that we can help those years most. We can help a family catch up with a patient to the stage of anger, or help a family slow down a bit while the patient's in the stage of bargaining. And they say, we know he's going to die. We know that there's no point in his fighting like this. But the patient needs it, and we can help them understand it. So the connection, I call it symptomization, a family and patient, and the pilgrimage in the valley. Now, it seems to me that the goal of pastoral care becomes the goal of helping the patient and his family come to the point of accepting the appropriateness. Accepting the appropriateness. Now, the key word for me is appropriateness. I don't think a person can ever come to accept his diagnosis and prognosis and accept that unless he can feel it is appropriate. And I have yet to meet a family who could come to accept the loss of a loved one unless they could reach a point existentially where they could feel this is the time, it is appropriate. Now, there are many factors that go on in this. It's inappropriate for an 8-year-old child to die, but if you see that child shrivel up into nothing from weakness, from pain and hurt, until their little arms and legs are punched full of needles, you begin to reach a point where it is appropriate now. The child deserves no more suffering. You've got to help the patient's family to come to feel the appropriateness if you ever expect them to achieve the suffering. And yet, I'm firmly convinced of my work with these patients that no one has ever come to see the appropriateness of death until they can find meaning in it. And this brings me to the three dimensions of pastoral care that make up essentially my perspective. First of these is the spiritual dimension of self. Now, I consider this to be universal of all human beings, and I think that a prerequisite of working with dying patients is to accept the wholeness of the personality, emotionally, physically, spiritually, and socially. I think it's universally true of all human beings that they have a built-in need, the energy, body, and power, drive, or instinct, whatever you want to call it, a gift that we're born with, the need for meaning, purpose, and some kind of fulfillment of that meaning and purpose. I think it's just as basic to the human personality as dependency, as aggression, and it's sexuality. The other kinds of needs that we understand are given to the personality. You ask, well, where is it? In a 10-year-old, well, I'll be like Freud, but it's written. When he talks about sexuality. I think that the need for meaning seems to be latent, that is, under the surface, until a person reaches late adolescence, young adulthood. And then it comes out in the form of identity crisis. Who am I? Why was I born? What am I going to do with my life? Do I marry? Do I remain single? Do I go to seminary, become a minister, become a doctor? What do I do with my life? What's life all about? just as much a given as puberty is a given in emerging. It's part of our sexuality. Now, if this is true, then it seems to me we have to take very seriously from late adolescence to the end of life as to what is the meaning of my life. What is fulfillment? How can I find some kind of meaning and purpose? So the self without meaning experiences sickness and death. And this spiritual sickness can fragment the person to where you wind up in the first few months talking about this and talking about people living on or dead. With people who are spiritually dead in terms of emptiness and death, long before their body dies. Many people face death as a welcome relief to the hell of an empty physical existence. If you have any doubts about that, just visit a geriatric center. As people whose lives have lost meaning and purpose, their disexistence, their spirits are dead. However, the self without fulfillment of meaning, even though he has some sense of meaning and purpose to his life, but does not find fulfillment, experiences a frustration which may see death as increasing and aborting, with the frustration intensifying the anger that he feels in the drama of catharsis. It sometimes becomes a question not only of why me in anger, but why now, because life is being frustrated. This is vividly shown to us in a 43-year-old opera singer who was just about to begin her first major concert tour. 32 concerts a year. She'd been married 7 months, her first marriage. She brought her mother over from Europe, from the old country, and bought her a home. Her mother was blind, had worked hard to send her to music school and all. And she was beginning to repay her mother and make her mother's life easier. When she developed a carcinoma of a job, it was a huge swelling to the. By the time she got to our hospital, it was up like this. She called it a monster. That invaded her face. She'd gone to the doctor in New York, he did a biopsy, he walked into the room in the hospital, said, that's the truth on him. You're going to have to cancel your tour of Europe, in fact, you probably won't be able to sing again. Matter of fact, I'll be surprised if you're alive in 6 months. You have an illusion type of moment. He turned around and walked out. And the next month of her life began panic. There was no going back to business of denial. She allowed no room for denial. Walked out, that was it. She panicked, began running. She came to our place because of a research project we had where one of our doctors was starving malignant cells.
This leads into my second reaction, that is what you said about stars. And the finding out where these people are, so that I sense in people very often as the kind of feel that Christians ought not to be sorrowful, or they ought not to be afraid of death. And that if they have these feelings, there's something really quite wrong with their Christian faith. And I see this not only in the patients, but also in the response. That somehow, give some evidence of this, either in anger or in cry or something like this, that Christians just don't do that because we're beyond that point. That leads me to the third point, and that's when talking again. I guess I keyed in on this whole thing of trying to learn where this person is so that you can speak to them, and sometimes relationship and know to what you're speaking really be helpful. This is to sense their own problems and their own grief. And the thing that I made a note of here is I think we have to be pretty careful about talking about death as a blessing. It may very well be a blessing, properly understood. I think you better know where those people are, where the other person is, where the person is facing death before you say that. And part of this comes from an experience that we had personally, and that was we had a mentally retired child, and the child died, and while I knew perfectly well what the people meant, when they said, well, after all, this is a blessing. And you know, I didn't feel like that was a blessing at all. We loved this child. We saw this child in a way nobody else saw this child. And it was really, had I not been able to understand, it was really brutal for me to have people say, well, after all, it was a blessing. I knew what they meant. I understood this. But it also taught me to be just a little bit more careful. Even with the, you know, the person who's 95 years old, and people are quick to say this because they don't know what else to say, or the person who's moving toward death, and I think we need to take care. The last point that I would make on this, the last things we talked about, that with this, the words and the feelings and the difference in faith, that a couple things seems to me can happen. One is that we transfer our feelings onto the person who's gone, so that we begin to feel that they're feeling like we are, and they may not be feeling that way at all. And the other one is that where they have feelings, where they're able to verbalize it very well, but really haven't come to grips with what's going to happen, that we allow this to happen too. So that if the person has some really great doubt, seems to me that if they're able to say that to the pastor, to whoever is visiting them, without the feeling that they're going to say once again, I learned what's the matter with your Christianity, you know, that Jesus Christ died and rose for you, that we allow them to say these things without immediately transferring again our own feelings, because after all, most of us at least have not been where these people are. And that if they can express those things up together, we can work these things through and really be helpful. I guess my final comment is that I constantly think that in this kind of ministry with people who are ill, with people who are dying, and with the family, I really believe that most of the time when some meaningful relationship has come up, that I come out being helped a whole lot more than ministry to the dying patient and going through the valley. We've at the same time, we can say all the way through our life that we ourselves are going in this valley, and to the degree that we are traveling and just what you use the term intrinsic and extrinsic faith, I find myself this struggle of that my, you know, I know what you mean when you talk about extrinsic. And I think that you know what you mean when you talk about intrinsic, and feel that I'm very much more in the extrinsic and wanting it to be intrinsic, and that struggle of what I've learned. What's your example? You know, to what degree don't we in the church, with our proclamation of resurrection, asleep in Jesus, help people deny the reality of death? And that the answer to that is the way you gave it this afternoon. It's a matter of how you use those words, whether it's coming out of a repetition, out of a faith that you've learned that you ought to believe, or is it something that you do believe yourself? And that you yourself can celebrate life. And can say that death is appropriate. I mean, now, again, that's the kind of what all of us stop to do, to think of death as really appropriate. Confronting with the meaning of one's life, and that you only can find that not through some kind of what somebody else believes, only to what the Spirit himself says that we're doing. And that I find for me in my ministry, a cook with elderly and geriatric, that that's finally the ministry that I need. The best ministry that I bring to them is the one that I bring of where I'm at with myself. That I find that to be most satisfying for myself, as well as what I think helps it. So, I guess my this is really to repeat what my reaction to what you said in the afternoon is, he's not so much given us again an answer, but a kind of an invitation to continue in the walk in the valley, and that I get from you also the stimulus and encouragement to continue. So thank you. Two responses, as you call clergymen. My first one was the one that was from a commercial. It was out a few months ago, and they were advertising Cougars automobiles from us. And the commercial went, "How did they get that Cougar on top of that Lincoln Mercury sign?" And the response was, "Very carefully." And my first response to your first part of your question was that. Second one came to several, but some of you all said it was that, and that is that I guess I have more fun and fulfillment out of coming to places to speak like this and all, because I believe very strongly in the old maid who had all the answers but was never asked a question. That I think all too often we have more answers than we've ever listened to the questions about. And the dying person, I thought you put it very well. The dying patient often asks us the question, what is it for? Now, I think when we talk about gut feelings, we have to talk about what things make us anxious. And not just things about death, but acknowledging that death is a built-in anxiety. The threat of non-being and the thought of separation from everything we've known are real threats. And things that remind us of that will make us uncomfortable until we deal with it. And when we deal with only one of the things, as you gentlemen very well pointed out, and use religious language in God talks to answer one, there is a blessing. What do I have to worry about? I believe that I'll be upstairs. Fine. But what about the other thing of giving up my four children and my wife? Yes, and even giving up my father-in-law and my bishop, I've put positive in it. Everything I've known, every source of meaning here. So when it's a blessing, it doesn't mean I can't do it. Now, when you or someone or I, if somebody gets to my closest friend ladies in the hospital, and we've had several of them, and identify with service, I relive a whole lot of things. But what can I do with that anxiety? One of you mentioned the title class. Well, you know, back a few years ago, our oldest daughter began to bruise easily, all over. And the doctor said, well, we want to do some tests because it may just be nothing, but this is also a symptom of leukemia. Well, we won't know until the tests are run. It turned out to be that she was short on vitamins. And a lot of orange juice brought her back up to normal. But in those days that we waited, in those days that we waited, we had to do a complete inventory on what our daughter meant to us. And also what children meant to us, and how we were caught up, which is where you have all the answers but never ask the question. whole meaning of our children to us, my wife and I, when we did this together. The anxiety was there, but it became creative, and we, even after we turned out not to be the senior, just the anticipation of it caused the question. Knowing what the answers, what the answers we had before were out of here, and we had to rethink. And our children have taken on different meaning ever since. I'm sure something else will happen and be ready to get. Maybe the baby, if you take it for once and for all. He talks very kindly about my feeling about choking. I still hurt. You see, today I came close to choking up several times. As I remember what particular patients have meant to me. Now, I didn't tell you about some of the more painful ones. I did mention the girl in life. See, that was a reference. But if it happens to you, what does it mean to you? Do you know what it is that threatens? Is it fear of death itself? Or is it just the frustration that you're losing all that you've known? Does it tell you that perhaps there are some things bugging you that need to be worked on? In other words, treat this syndrome and not the symptom. We ministers are good about treating symptoms. You know, doctors are very careful about giving aspirin to a patient with a headache unless they've ruled out the possibility of a brain tumor. All too often, we treat symptoms and forget about the syndrome, and our anxiety is always a message. What is making you anxious? So I don't know how much part of it goes personally on that, but I'm saying that sort of to people in general. What is it that makes you anxious? That's where your gut feelings come in. You learn to trust your gut feelings, you learn that certain things make you anxious, certain things make you angry, certain things make you feel guilty. Your parishioners, some of those female parishioners have a way of making you feel responsible for their problems. You're guilty. We had a psychiatrist who was a beautiful Belgian. I did not want him to apologize. He's a terrific, very strong, rigid guy, but he's the one who taught me about how to use gut feelings. And I know one day we were visiting a woman who was just raking us up across the coals. This is a consultation now. Raking him across the coals to see his pregnant. Finally, he said, "Look, Mrs. Smith, I didn't get you pregnant." But I went back and talked about it. It was a reality check for her, but I went back and talked about it in a meeting. Not only did he begin to feel guilty that she was pregnant, but we also did, but he was able to recognize the manipulation. And rather than respond to it by feeling guilty, as he calls it, he puts them in a reality check. That's not realistic. What's realistic about the anxieties we get about a particular kind of illness? So that we pinpoint it and it doesn't go off into some kind of way out thinking. And once you get it pinpointed realistically, what does it mean? What can we learn from it? What questions are being asked about our existence, about our theology? About our own intrinsic, but intrinsic. So, I don't know whether that's given any guidelines. I appreciate you saying I didn't give you answers because I'm trying to give you a conceptualization of the thing. Elizabeth Ross, she'd say yes. She'd say, "Keep things all of war, it's like
move it. I think political science and economics, but with a fellow named Marx that lived on some more, who had a lot to do with everything too. I don't know. If we are, I say let's use it. Perhaps it could be God sent. I'm not sure from the young people I talk to, Thomas back in Chicago, and by the way, we, our local college newspapers advertising where you send off the $10 and get your good ordained by these churches in Colorado and California. Mm-hmm. Then you become entitled to rent, food, all kinds of stuff. I wish that our young people were mature enough in Chicago that that was an issue of mature death. There's an awful lot of adolescent rebellion and reactions in Chicago toward going to Vietnam. If you were to apply the same thing, then they might be more careful driving on the highways, they might be more careful with drugs and a lot of other things that are also built in danger. Suicide is the highest problem, the second highest cause of death among young adults in this country, right after automobile accidents? Suicide. I don't think they're all committing suicide because of Vietnam. I think we've got a real problem of inadequate life perspective for our young people because they see the phoniness of our materialism. They're not acquiring that as life perspective. It's hard to get men to go to business now. They want to go into something else. Doctors wanted to go work here and work there. Social action areas. I think we've got a real critical issue of meaning. That's what we're facing here. And the fear of death may be one dynamic, but I don't think it's the only dynamic. I think what's life all about? Now, here, I think Martin Luther King had a very helpful comment when he said, if you don't have something to die for, you don't have anything to live for. And Martin Heidegger said it a long time ago when he said, to make sense out of life, you've got to begin with death. But he's a contemporary, still alive, and you can go a lot further back than that. Talk about a church that began, as New Testament view, we're talking about the resurrection at the beginning of our faith. I may not have answered your question. I think it's much more essential for you. My oldest boy is 8. But my wife's still talking about it already. And he's raising the question. I don't know that I can let him say it, she says. Maybe somebody else wants to speak to that who's been here. The old acquired life perspectives that were meaningful to our generation, they're no longer meaningful to the young generation, and the spontaneous ones that they're picking up aren't proving to be much more relevant or adequate. And it's a real person. And the drug problems, I think, is just one. It's not just experiments. People are looking for a lot of other things, too. But if you got that out of it, that was worth a trip down here. You've got to find out who you are. We hope it will be helpful for them too.
but the seminar is conducted as a teacher, and we don't try therapy. We try to make it therapeutic in the seminar, but not therapy. But every person who's seen the seminar is followed. And currently, for the last year, they've been followed by a student chaplain in my CTE program, or someone helping them. But a lot of our patients have already, who are coming to the seminar, have already been seen by a student chaplain in CTE, so he follows them with the help, perhaps, of a psychiatrist or of the supervisor or something. We understand and drop them. That's clear. That's exploding people. Obviously, there have been some errors in that. People who've gone home and we've asked them to let us know when they're back, and the man that was in CTE when they were there before is gone. I've got one lady who's known 11 chaplains in the 7 years she's been coming to the hospital. But she's a lovable kind of person who looks forward to the next one. I've got some who've been very angry one time. And the patient we had this last week came as an outpatient to the conference. And her wheelchair was pushed by a student of mine from 3 years ago who kept in touch as a pastor. And he came to the seminar on anybody because he called him because he's going to do it. And wanted to know. Let's separate that part from her retiring, you know, the teacher bit versus our trying to help the patient. Is that clear?
Yeah.
And let's get to the other question. Thank you.
Well, it varies with the patient, and it varies with what happened in the seminar. And you know, we've had 400 patients who've worked with mostly patients their life. They're common denominators, but they're different numerators. Let's remember that with our patients and our physicians. And Joe may remind you of time, but Joe is the time, so that's what we're going to miss. When I say we follow them, I mean that if they were referred to us by a psychiatrist, then the next year he's following them, and he listens to the discussion of the patient and the interview and our recommendations. If he's followed by a student chaplain, we make sure that the regular visits go along and that the feedback and consultation about where the guy is going and what's likely to happen. Some of the patients don't want much follow-up. They just want to be told if they did well in the seminar and that's that. And they never tell us that. Others who've been in the seminar years ago are still keeping in touch. When they come back to the hospital, they call. 12 patients have called us and they were back in and said, you still running that seminar? I want to come again. So maybe the seminar is the way we meet their needs by having them come again. Other times it's just coming and talk. We've got one lady who's given up for death. She's really dying.